Hello and welcome to On the Line. I'm Carl Richter. Dr. Drew Morton has made an academic career out of studying popular culture, film and TV, video games, comics, and more. The Associate Professor of Mass Communications at A&M Texarkana edited the recent essay collection, After Midnight, Watchmen After Watchmen. The book's contributors together take a deep dive into the HBO series Watchmen, a sequel to the classic graphic novel of the same name. He and I talked about how Watchmen became a cultural watershed, his other work, and a lot more. Here's my conversation with Drew Morton. Joining me from Los Angeles, it's Dr. Drew Morton, Associate Professor of Mass Communication at Texas A&M University, Texarkana. How are you, Drew?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for having me today.
Sure. We're going to talk about the book you recently edited. It's called After Midnight, Watchmen After Watchmen. Now, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this don't have any idea what Watchmen is. So could you please just sort of summarize that?
Sure. Watchmen is kind of known as one of the holy grails of comics. Essentially, there was this big year in comic book history, 1986-1987, where you had three titles come out in rapid succession. You had Art Spiegelman's Mouse, a graphic novel about his parents going through the Holocaust. You had Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, which was this kind of revisiting of Batman after about 40, 50 years of his presence in the comic book medium. And then you had Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' Watchmen. And what Watchmen and Miller's Batman did was kind of take the superhero genre and kind of flip them on its edge a little bit and kind of question kind of base themes and base storytelling conventions of basically the superhero myth, like what makes someone a superhero. And both texts are kind of critical about what a superhero is. One of the kind of mantras within Watchmen is who watches the Watchmen, who monitors the superheroes. When you have these kind of godlike figures on Earth, you know, who is the power that kind of oversees whether or not they're operating in the best interests of society or not. So Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, Watchmen was kind of known, these three titles in Watchmen in particular were known as the comic books that made kind of comics for adults again. Because essentially, beginning in the 50s through the Cold War, there was this time period where comic books got very, very dumbed down and were very much addressed to children because of self-censorship codes and things like parents boycotting comics and burning them and Frederick Wortham's study and all that. So it was really in 86 with those three titles, and particularly Watchmen, which won the Hugo, and I think it won a Nebula Award, that really changed the orientation of how American culture thought about comic books.
Talk a little bit more about Alan Moore. He's a real big figure in the comics world, and people might be familiar with other things he created.
Sure. So Alan Moore is a British comic book artist. He had started off with things like Swamp Thing, Judge Dredd. I think he had worked on for a bit. And then he's known for really three big volumes, maybe four. V for Vendetta, which is, you know, been made into a movie. And again, kind of like Watchmen questions the concept of what a superhero is and what purpose a superhero serves in society. It takes place in a dystopian, kind of Orwellian version of Britain, where there's a superhero named V who is kind of fighting this totalitarian regime. Alan Moore also did From Hell, which again was another film, but had very little to do with the actual graphic novel. If folks are into true crime or something like that, they may really get into the Alan Moore From Hell, which is basically the size of a phone book and has a bibliography. That's kind of how hard in the paint he went with trying to, you know, really solve the Jack the Ripper killings on that one. And then League of the Extraordinary Gentlemen is probably his third best known title. But he's had kind of a torturous relationship with the comic book industry over the years. Essentially, he had been promised for a long period of time that people wouldn't license and reprint his work and he'd be treated fairly. And as the comic book industry tends to do, especially the American one, they really take advantage of their writers and artists. So Alan Moore famously will never watch an adaptation or, you know, do a sequel to Watchmen, which is of course, the subject of the book. It's a televisual sequel and a comic book sequel that were made without Alan Moore's blessing. And in fact, he came out and basically said, he flat out said that I don't want to have anything to do with these two pieces of media.
He's sort of infamously cynical and sort of curmudgeonly, correct?
Yeah, and he's got some reason to be, but yeah, it's very curmudgeonly. So I think one of the reasons and what I tried to deal with in the introduction is that it took people a long time to really come around to the idea that you could continue Watchmen despite Alan Moore's wishes and do it in a fruitful way. And I think the HBO series in particular, that is the bulk of the focus of the book, really does Alan Moore's work justice. I think it does, it carries on the themes of his original work in a new way. It doesn't just retread old material. And that's why I think the show resonated with so many people. So while I certainly sympathize with Alan Moore's position, I do think he's missing out on a really great television show that the folks at HBO and Damon Lindelof came up with.
There was a sequel comic series too. I'm blanking on the title at the moment.
There was a sequel comic called Doomsday Clock, and then there was a prequel comic called Before Watchmen, I think it was called. And that came out about 6-7 years ago, and that the prequel was not well received, which is why when DC started talking about trying to fold in Watchmen into the New 52, the New 52 was a initiative that DC Comics took on maybe about 10-12 years ago, where essentially they were concerned about readership dwindling off for comic books. As I often tell my comic book students when they're in my comic book history class, it can be kind of daunting if you were a kid in the 20-aughts and you went into a comic book store and you were looking at, Batman comics. They were on like number 998 or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So people were like, well, what happened in the other 997 issues? I got to catch up on like 1,000 issues of comic books to understand. So that I think was really intimidating to newcomers. So what the New 52 kind of set out to do was like, let's restart everything and start over with number one and take the heroes and kind of riff on the stories that you've been familiar with and try to make it fresh for new audiences. So part of that was trying to bridge over Watchmen into the world of Batman and Superman, because that narrative was not originally set in that world.
Right.
If you read Watchmen, the Alan Moore comic, there's no crossover. There's no references to other characters. It's set in New York City. It's not set in Gotham City or Metropolis or anything else like that. It's kind of its own universe and its own world. And so that was the main kind of desire with that sequel comic. Doomsday Clock was to kind of bring everything together under one roof.
And in the world of Watchmen, the popular comics are all about pirates, right? Not superheroes.
Are all about what?
Pirates.
I'm trying to remember if there are other comics in there. There's the ones about pirates, there's the horror comics. A lot of what Alan Moore does in those sections of Watchmen with the actual references to comics have more to do with kind of the EC comics of the 50s and 60s, stuff like Tales from the Crypt. And what people tend to forget about those genre comics is even though they were very graphic and very violent, which is why one of the reasons to return to that point earlier about self-censorship, one of the reasons the industry embraced it was because EC Comics were kind of put under the spotlight and, you had parent groups freaking out and stuff like that. But they were also very kind of socially aware. Mm-hmm. So you have comics and you've got this anecdote about Max Gaines going in front of the Senate subcommittee talking about a comic where he's got an African-American lead in it in like the 50s or 60s. Yeah. And it's, that was kind of a thing you didn't normally do. And it was very outrageous. And people thought it was kind of offensive because the African-American guy was sweating and they were like, this is grotesque. He's like, well, are you offended that he's sweating or are you offended that he's black? So Moore is really trying to kind of, I think, rehabilitate some of those comics and kind of bring people's attention back to them in the 80s and be like, hey, these were really great pulp comics that were kind of derided as being genre pieces, but actually had rich kind of social commentary in them, which of course is what superhero comics used to do, mm-hmm. right? If we go back and we look at the cover of Captain America number one, he's punching Hitler in the face, right? If you go back and you look at the Batman and Superman comics in the you know, World War II era, they are deeply political. They start to come back around even during the war in Vietnam to kind of politics. So the idea that comic books and superheroes don't have anything to do with the contemporary moment or don't do with politics was really just something that was particular to that era where it kind of got kid-friendly mm-hmm. from roughly the 50s until the 80s. And then it kind of became, you know, hey, we need to engage with the present, which is what Moore does so well in Watchmen, where it is this kind of tale about, you know, nuclear annihilation and the Cold War.
So back to the book, it's a collection of, would you say, academic essays? I mean, this isn't really for a general audience, is it?
I would say it's primarily for academics. It's written in such a way that it's designed to be accessible. So I don't think an undergraduate or someone like that would have a hard time with it. Based on the reviews that the book has gotten, I think people who enjoy comic books could read it. I don't think it's too dry. Mm-hmm. But there's citations and there's some theory and, you know, it can be a little intimidating, I think, if you're expecting something like Scott McCloud understanding comics. It's up a little rung from that, but I don't think it's inaccessible either. And that's what we were aiming for. We wanted something that was thoughtful, but you know, you didn't need a PhD to be able to understand it.
Right. So what did you want to do with the book? This it's all about these later iterations of Watchmen, correct? The TV series and the later comic series, correct?
Yeah, so it's largely, I would say, 90% about the HBO series. And there's maybe a chapter or two that are about the comic book series. For listeners who don't know, the comic book sequel and the televisual sequel on HBO, which was just called Watchmen, so if there's any confusion, I'll refer to it as Watchmen by HBO if it helps. Mm-hmm. The HBO series was kind of running concurrently to to Doomsday Clock, the comic book sequel. They have nothing in common. They don't share the same story. They're not an adaptation. They're just two very different sequels. It's set in two very different canonical worlds, right? Mm-hmm. And as Doomsday Clock was coming out, people were like, oh, this is not a bad comic. It's, you know, there's some interesting points and I kind of like what it's doing. But very quickly, once the HBO show started, and people were watching it, by like episode 3 or 4, they were like, this is such a better, you know, this is a much better sequel. And this is much more ripe for like, you know, making new observations, whereas the Doomsday Clock comic just felt like it was kind of running in place and, you know, doing what Alan Moore had already done. So that kind of comes out in the book a little bit, where there's that kind of just general preference for the television show versus the comic. Mm-hmm. So my goal as an editor, having watched that show, was, again, you saw a creator who was like, I'm going to use superheroes to analyze a topical social American issue. And while Moore was, you know, a British guy analyzing the Cold War and politics in America in the 80s, Damon Lindelof was like, hey, I want to use the superhero tropes to kind of unpack the legacy of racism in America across the 20th century. And I think that decision really kind of shook people up, because it was this kind of, it came at this moment when we were starting to have larger cultural discussions about policing, about social justice reform. And I think it really dovetailed in some cases very tragically with contemporary events, and so it resonated in a way that the comic book sequel did not. And having kind of seen some of my colleagues discussing it really thoughtfully, I was like, there really needs to be a book on this. There's just so much rich soil to be kind of you know, milled here and heart and, you know, some conversations to be had that I really wanted to kind of do the work to make sure that those analyses got to come out.
Hey, everyone. I want you to know how proud I am to welcome Hostetler Roofing as a sponsorship partner. I had the pleasure to meet with some of Hostetler's staff, and I could tell they really mean it when they say they're all about honesty, integrity, and accountability. They get it that contractors don't have the best reputation, and they want to change people's minds about that by setting an example. Everything Hostetler Roofing does is about taking care of customers. Whether it's a commercial or residential job, maintenance, repair, or a whole new roof. That's why they offer 5- and 10-year workmanship warranties on everything they do. Hostetler has a huge variety of roofing styles and materials available, and they're happy to help you with options to pay for their work, from affordable financing to applying for government grants. It all starts with a free inspection. Just call and ask, and before you know it, you'll get the best advice out there about your roof. Visit HostetlerRoofing.com or call 870-557-4797 to get started. And please mention you heard about them here. So let's talk about your academic work more generally. Your profile includes studying video games, film, pop culture. Do you ever have to encounter people who may think that's all sort of frivolous or unserious?
I think initially that's always people's kind of reaction, right? And I bring this up in my class all the time where, you know, you'll see some, you know, news story in the New York Post where, you know, someone's trying to dunk on Harvard or, you know, Berkeley for offering a class on, like, in the English program on, like, the literature of Taylor Swift, they'll use for an example, or the literature of Beyonce, right? And it's like, people are like, well, what are these college kids learning? And it's like, well, we're using that object, whether it's Taylor Swift, whether it's Beyonce, whether it's Watchmen, to deal with questions of media literacy. So it's a Trojan horse is what it is. So, like, we're using something shiny and relevant that the kids care about, that the students want to learn about, to basically just teach them kind of core media literacy concepts, like understanding the relationship between the First Amendment and, you know, popular culture and expression, and understanding the roles of business conglomerates and how laws can shape what kind of content is made, and, you know, those kinds of things. So it's not like we're just focusing on, hey, did you like this superhero movie, or did you, you know, was it action packed enough? It's just a way of trying to get the conversation started with an object that they're already familiar with. So there's always kind of a little bit of resistance to it. But I think once people understand the underlying philosophical goals, which seem maybe a little more inside baseball, maybe a little more highfalutin, and some folks may be, you know, familiar with engaging with, you know, then it becomes a little more acceptable. By the end of the class, I typically tell students two things. First off, you're probably going to hate me because you're going to do this thing that you tell me at the end of classes that you can't stop thinking about what you're watching. And you think that's a bad thing. And then a couple of months later, you're like, I can't stop thinking about what I'm watching now. And I kind of like it. I have a deeper appreciation of it. And when I hear that, I always kind of come back to them with a sports analogy. I was like, hey, do you like sports? Do you like football? Do you like basketball? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, does it hamper your understanding? Does it ruin your experience of those sports to know how to read box scores or to understand what the different positions do or to know how the game is played? And they're like, no. And I was like, well, that's exactly what we're doing here. We're just going behind the scenes to understand all of these pieces of media that you spend a lot of your money and a lot of your time on, because, you know, that's kind of important to understanding our basic human experience.
Tell me more about video game studies. This is even newer than comics studies, I would assume.
Video game Studies has been around for about 20, 30 years, I want to say.
Okay.
So, yeah, so there's like a range of different approaches to it where you have some folks who, you know, study the general properties of like the social communities that come out of gaming. There's a whole genre of what's called kind of platform studies where they analyze how the different hardware and the different interfaces kind of shape our experiences of how we play. So it's been in existence for a while. It's just been in disparate pockets where some of it comes out of like computer science. One of the first people who wrote on it, I can't remember her name. I always feel so horrible. She wrote a dissertation on it, I believe in the 80s, and it was on like ludic literature. Ludic literature is kind of like the idea of like a choose your own adventure book, right?
Oh, right.
She's kind of looking at these books where you're basically doing an interactive narrative, but it's in text form. And she was in like an English department and people didn't know what she was doing at the time. They're like, what are you doing with like Zork here and trying to equate it to these choose your own adventure books? And she was about 5 or 10 years ahead of her time because the Academy just didn't really value what she did. And I think she became like a masseuse or something. And then all of a sudden, all these people discovered her dissertation and were writing about it. And were like, wow, this, you know, she was really ahead of the curve on this and kind of rehabilitated her work. So that's one of the dangers about being on the cutting edge, unfortunately. I dabble more with the video game stuff. It's something that interests me. I did a lot more work on it probably 10 or 15 years ago, but yeah, it just kind of fell by the wayside. It's one of those things that's, I find now, when I do my scholarship, so much of what I write about and what I decide to research comes out of my teaching, right? What I'm doing in the classroom. And at least at a small school like Texas A&M, Texarkana, that's kind of hard to do to teach video games, where it's like you would need everyone to have the same system and the same game and the same capacity to play, you know, like a Fortnite or something like that. It's difficult to kind of get students beyond like cell phone games, where that's something that almost everyone has in their pocket.
Right, yeah.
So I've tried it a couple times. We had a PlayStation 4, I think, with VR, and I used it in a couple classes to try to teach them about realism. But it was tough to like basically be like, hey, we're all going to play this game, and you know, in the same way that you would in an English class, you know, we're all going to read this book this week. And yeah, it's never an easy thing to teach, especially because these video games can last so long now, where they're playing for 30, 40 hours before they can finish.
Yeah. I saw you got your graduate degrees in film studies at UCLA, correct?
Yeah, it's cinema and media studies. It's kind of the same thing as film studies. It's just, as you kind of alluded to, just a little kind of background. So film studies comes out of English departments, and it's kind of this moment in the 60s where people are like, hey, you know, I don't want to write about Shakespeare. I want to write about John Wayne Westerns. So the English people are like, what are you doing over here? You're writing about like movies? And so film studies gradually evolved into this much larger field because we just kind of kept claiming everything else. Where we're like, oh, you want to write about TV? You're in the club. You want to write about video games? You're in the club now. So it becomes something much larger, which is basically just media studies. So that's typically an easier way for people to kind of understand what it is that I do. But yeah, I did my master's and PhD at UCLA.
Well, that sounds like a great place to learn all about the movie business for sure. And lots of other content creation, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, it was pretty incredible because the program there was in the film school. So you'd take these classes and you'd have directors, you know, dropping in the lecture and, you know, people talking about projects they were actually like working on or trying to sell and some of the challenges they were running into. So yeah, you really got your hands in it if you wanted to. So that was a really great experience.
What kind of film studies classes do you teach at A&M?
It's much more generalized because it's a mass communication program. So I teach like American film history, which is in our core curriculum. And the goal of that class, they have these kind of learning objectives. I'm trying not to use teacher speak.
Right.
It might be easier for your audience. But essentially, like, you know, if a student's in a university setting, they have to take general education classes that try to, like, again, use, like, the class as a Trojan horse to teach them something else, right? Mm-hmm. So in my American film class, I have to teach them about social and personal responsibility. So I try to pick a couple films throughout the class and a couple historical moments where this was reflected in the history of American filmmaking. So something like The Blacklist. The anti-communist kind of witch hunts in the 1950s becomes the focus of one of the weeks and stuff like that. But again, it's kind of a basic media literacy class. Here's how you analyze movies. Here's how they're made. Here are economic things you need to consider when you're watching them or you might want to be mindful of. Here's how we can think about kind of issues of representation, whether it involves women or minorities. So just trying to give people kind of a basic toolkit in how to analyze moving images around them. So I teach that class. For the majors, I teach kind of other more production type classes. So I teach like intro to visual media production where they actually make short films. Mm. I teach a film theory class, which is a little more philosophical in nature, where they learn about like how to analyze what a genre is in film, you know, what makes a horror movie different than, you know, a thriller, something like that. And then some journalism classes and stuff like that.
Sort of bring the two strands together. Do you think the superhero movie boom is over or close to it? It sure seems like it.
I don't know. Like, I think there's fatigue.
Yeah.
I think there's superhero fatigue, and I think there's been other moments in history where there's been superhero fatigue. Whenever I teach my American comic book class, which is every other year, it's an elective for my upper division students. You know, we kind of go through the history of comic book movies and, you know, you don't get them until the 70s when you get the first Superman movie. And then it's still kind of slow until you get the Batman film in 1989. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the superhero genre kind of imploded very quickly where you had Warner Brothers cranking out these Batman movies with, you know, George Clooney and Val Kilmer and kind of goofy, you know, puns and, you know, bat nipples on the bat suit, and it became a punchline, right? So, that what year was that? That was like 97, I think. So, like, it was like 97. Batman and Robin comes out. It doesn't do very well. You got Arnold Schwarzenegger. You got to kind of get dunked on like late night television, and people were like, "I think these superhero movies are finally done." And yeah, they disappeared for about, you know, 5-6 years, and then Batman Begins comes back and Iron Man. So I think it's just, it's like any other genre, right? Mm-hmm. People like, the pro and con of a genre is that people have expectations of what it's going to be, right? That's the whole kind of magic of a genre. Like, you know, when you're going to a horror movie that you're going to be scared, you know, if you're going into a rom-com, what kind of story you're getting. But the kind of challenge is that you want that story, you just don't want it in the same form that you always get it in.
Right.
So I think right now with the industry and what these creative executives are facing is how can we make this new and fresh? And the challenges, and I think this is what may be unique to this moment in time, is the kind of openness of the audience to accept new types of stories, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because I think we've seen this with things like, with like Star Wars, where, you know, you see The Last Jedi and where it's really trying to challenge some of the norms of what we expect out of a Star Wars story, and people get really angry, right?
Yeah.
And then their profit margins hurt. And so then, you know, there's people who are taking risks and they get, you know, kind of kneecapped at the box office. And then it's like, well, we can't take risks anymore, but if we keep doing the same thing and just cranking out Marvel movies that are just, you know, telling you the same story over and over again, and no one ever dies, and there's never really any stakes because everything's always the same.
Yeah.
You know, there just has to be a middle ground there. And I think people want that. And I think people are kind of hungry for it. And that's kind of the middle rail where I see things like the Watchmen HBO show, or even the Spider-Verse films. They're really trying to kind of carve out a new lane for themselves, and it almost becomes a form of superhero film or movie or television show in the case of the HBO show. That's very similar to actually what Alan Moore did in 86 with Watchmen, where he's kind of doing a deconstruction. He's kind of doing in some ways, a parody of what a superhero is, right? Mm-hmm. He's critiquing a superhero. So I think people are kind of into it when it's like, hey, play around with the genre, have fun with it, do what Deadpool's doing, or do what...
The Boys.
What's the John? Yeah, The Boys, or the John Cena show that I can't remember the name of off the top of my head.
Liberator.
Yeah. Peacemaker.
Peacemaker, yeah.
Peacemaker, yeah. So I think people kind of like that. But again, it's like, you need more than just two flavors. And this is what, you know, this is always going to be the challenge with comic book fans, where sometimes they just kind of get stuck in one mindset. And this happened in the 80s, where, you know, even when the Tim Burton Batman movie was coming out, the minute that Michael Keaton was leaked as playing Batman, you had all of these comic book fans who were like, it's going to be funny like that 1966 show that we all hated. You know, we can't have funny Batman again. We need dark and gritty Batman. And it's like, well, we had dark and gritty Batman for 30 years. Like, I love those dark and gritty Batmans. They're great. Like, it's also like, I want a different flavor.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to go away. I just think there might be a little bit of product fatigue, and they might retreat a little bit or come back in a different form or reboot it. You know, that's all it's going to be.
Well, we're about out of time. What's next for you? What are you working on now?
I am working on, so one of the other areas that we haven't really talked a bit about is, so I really kind of do two areas of specialty. One is the kind of comic book media that we've been talking about. The other is what I call videographic criticism, or maybe your audience would know better, is like video essays. So stuff like CinemaSins.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's like an academic version of that. So instead of like writing papers or making books, we will make actual like movies with our arguments about television shows or films kind of in them. So one of the people who got me into studying film is a filmmaker known, his name is Steven Soderbergh. He did like the Ocean's 11 movies. Mm-hmm. He did Magic Mike. He's a very kind of strange filmmaker because he'll do these really big Hollywood kind of blockbusters, like the Ocean's films, like Magic Mike. And then he'll do weird Oscar movies and weird indie movies like Traffic, or these movies where he's shooting them on his iPhone for like $5.
Right.
And I think because he's had this kind of very polarized career between these two very different kinds of modes, where he's either doing super indie work or super blockbuster work, people haven't really known how to like classify it. So I started writing about his work when I was an undergrad, and I thought he was really fascinating. Because of one movie in particular. It's a film called Out of Sight with George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez. Mm-hmm. It's a really great kind of Elmore Leonard bank heist movie. And I got into him because of that, and I kept waiting. You know, I'd done some writing on him, and, you know, I was kind of like, okay, other people can do this. I'm a little burned out. And then like 20 years went by, and I was like, still, no one's really like writing about him. So I kind of want to go back to that and, you know, look back at his work and reflect on it, especially now that he's made like another 20 some movies, because he's very prolific. So I'm going to try to do a videographic book about his work.
Cool.
Which I'm kind of looking forward to.
So summer in LA and then you're back to town. How's that work?
My wife and I have been in a long distance marriage. Most people outside of academia are kind of like, that's kind of funky, you know. It's like a lot of people who are professors or in the academy are kind of familiar with it, because it's very difficult to kind of have both of you end up in the same place. Mm-hmm. So when I was in graduate school, she kind of fell into work in the film industry. So she worked for the Directors Guild of America for about 10 years, and then she went over to the Oscars. And now she's at Netflix, so she's kind of set up a life for herself here. And I'm going to be honest, I kind of like to not be in the 110 degree heat in the summer. So I tend to come back and get my research on and take care of the house while she's working in the summers. And yeah, it's nice.
Well, that sounds great.
A lot of access to archives and museums, yeah, all that good stuff.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting you in person when you get back in town, and I'll be sure to put a link to where people can get the book in the show notes.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for your time. This is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. On the Line is a Texarkana Gazette podcast recorded in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Follow On the Line on Twitter at OTL TXK, and on our website, texarcanagazette.com/podcast. To support the show, post a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The show is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Carl Richter, and I'd love to hear from you. Email me at krichter@texarcanagazette.com. I'll see you next time on the line.